Go ahead.
Now we're complete.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Today, we have signed up for public hearing, House Bill 4039, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4039. And we are honored with the president of, with the co-chair of the House Revenue Committee, who really did the heavy lifting. The House Revenue Committee really did the heavy lifting on this bill, so I very much appreciate your willingness to come and go over it, Representative Berger. Before you do that, shall we just get a little summary from Christine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4039 has some changes that it makes to the TN deferral program. The main thing that would have a revenue impact would be to extend a two-year reprieve to people who have a reverse mortgage, who were already in the program, who were disqualified, and who actually filled out the recertification forms when prompted by the department. And that would extend their tax year payments for 2011, 2012, and 2012, 2013 tax years. That there's a number of other administrative changes that are made by that measure. There's a notification requirement for a financial institution to notify a borrower that there is a prohibition against participating in the senior deferral program or the disabled deferral program as they receive a reverse mortgage, and that they have to choose between one or the other, and they can't do both. It also has a provision that allows taxpayer to credit payments to deferred taxes that are payable upon becoming ineligible. It lets them apply those taxes to the taxes that don't have a delay of foreclosure on them first. It also specifies exactly what the county median real market value would mean, that it's class 101 only in all of the counties, just to simplify how that number is arrived at. And it also requires the Department of Revenue to certify the eligibility for deferral not less than once every 3 years, which is the same as the requirement before, but it gives them more flexibility in determining the group of people that they'll recertify each year, just to help smooth out the administrative workload there. And there is a minimal expenditure impact. Also, the revenue impact of extending that two-year reprieve to the people who have a reverse mortgage and who were in the program before is negative $6 million in the first year, and then that additional money will be repaid back so that the next two biennia have positive revenue impact slightly, but overall the revenue impact of this change is negative.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And now we will welcome Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, state representative from the Salem area. Senator Telfer will recall we were in a work group a couple of years ago when the Department of Revenue alerted us that there was a significant problem within this program. And in fact, the cupboard was bare. This was one of the, I think, as a result of the housing crisis and the downturn in the economy that left this program, which was basically a longstanding program based on appreciating home values. It worked fine. But when those home values turned the other way for the first time in my lifetime, really, and in, I think, since the Great Depression that we've seen this kind of a change in value, this program basically collapsed. Its funding source was gone. We being a number of folks, Representative Barnhart and I particularly, but a lot of folks from counties and your revenue staff, economists from the Department of Revenue, a lot of folks worked really hard, and Our goal has always been to save this program. We know there are states that didn't bother or weren't able to. They just simply discontinued it. But we believe that it has great value and that there are a core group of people who we have sort of indicated that this is one of the ways that we are going to help them out, and we wanted to retain that core. Now, remember, this program has sort of gone along with a cohort of around 5,000 for years who were using this, and it seems to be a sort of a 7-year cycle for individuals who use it and then are gone because they've sold their house over time. But since the housing crisis, that number of people in the program jumped to 10,400. We knew going into the changes that we couldn't maintain this program at that kind of level. And so we basically started with the easy things and said, all right, people who have high-value homes, great assets, don't need to be in this program because they have other options. Those were the easy decisions. And then we had to work through decisions where we knew we were cutting people out of this program who needed help in this economy. And those were the cuts that got, or sort of the policy decisions that got painful. And all of you heard about them too, folks who really are hurting in this economy and who are dependent on some sort of subsidy to stay in their home. We couldn't keep them all in, and so decisions had to be made as to how we could keep the core program and help as many people as we could. Ultimately, the decisions from last the changes that we made to this program from last session saved it. But we couldn't save it without an infusion of money, and so we borrowed from the Treasury. We did that with a clear understanding that we were putting this program on a path to solvency and would be replaying that short-term borrowing. This was not a long-term, go and just keep putting more money into it. It was a very specific arrangement that we could save the program with an infusion of cash, but the program had to pay that back. And the Ways and Means folks were very clear that they were not going to be saving it with general fund dollars, that it was our responsibility to put it on a path to solvency. With that in mind, we have watched the numbers, watched the housing market, analyzed all of the sort of projections, and we are now 6 months away, more than 6 months away from the original bill, and we believe that the solvency issue can be addressed. We are on a good path to paying back the loan and keeping the program solvent, and we can also reach in and help a cohort of folks that just hurt us terribly to have to take off the program on incredibly short notice. And those are the folks that we know applied and were denied because they had a reverse mortgage. They didn't see it coming. They were given almost no warning, and most of them have no recourse when their tax bill comes due. They don't have the resources. And a lot of them, I've heard from them, they borrowed short-term themselves to pay their taxes and stay in their home. But because the numbers, the economy, and our ability to manage this way out of the wilderness is looking, we believe, solid, and the numbers, I believe, are responsible, what this bill does is offer to this known cohort, in other words, we know how many there are, so we can run the numbers exactly. This known cohort, we are going to pay their property taxes for 2011 and 2012. The prohibition against reverse mortgages remains part of the program. And new people coming in cannot come in with a reverse mortgage. And another piece of this bill is that the folks who issue the reverse mortgage have to make that clear in the documents, that they have to explain to people, you get a reverse mortgage, you are therefore not eligible for this program. I will tell you, AARP, for instance, has a wonderful document on reverse mortgages. They make it pretty clear that a lot of states don't allow this program with reverse mortgages, and that if you're looking at a reverse mortgage, you better look carefully about your taxes, because you probably shouldn't get both programs. There's plenty of evidence that the reverse mortgage, of course, works against the funding source of this program, which is why we had to take it out. But by this bill, we hope to give this group of folks who really were caught very short in a very short timeline a reprieve, and then we can look at what the financial picture in the next session looks like and make whatever other adjustments to this program we feel is necessary. I would not recommend backing up on the prohibition against reverse mortgages. That I would not. But we will, as time goes on, we have better picture of what the housing market is doing and what this cohort is doing, and this is a specific cohort. There are also some technical amendments in there that Christine mentioned that came after it left our committee, that we would ask that you amend in to make the program more manageable for Department of Revenue and more clear in statute. With that, let me just say one other thing. Since this bill passed the House, I have been over time in correspondence with a number of specific seniors who were caught up in this, and they have various issues, and now I'm getting the letters, oh, you've saved me. I don't know if I've saved them, because I don't know. This is only a specific group who were denied only because of reverse mortgage. They may have had other issues, so I can't say, oh, yeah, I've saved you and be a hero here. I just have to say, you need to reapply. You need to see if you fit once the bill has passed. And, by the way, February 15th is a tax deadline for these folks. If they've paid a partial, then they owe more, and they're all faced with that. And I have heard from them. You will hear from them. Their stories are real and compelling. I would say that the folks that I've talked to who are on the edge are on the edge, and this is the sort of this tipping point that they're looking at. They are already on the edge. In terms of their financial situation and their ability to stay in their homes. And their stories, I feel them, you feel them. But I hold my head up because there are 5,000 people who are still in this program, a cohort who has depended on it, and there's another 1,700 who we are going to give a reprieve to. When I look at what's happened in other states where the program went away completely, I think we need to feel good about what we've done responsibly to keep this program alive. And I have tried to direct folks that I hear from to services within their community and see what help we can get them in other ways, because I really do feel their pain, and I think we all feel the pain of all the folks that are hurting out there because of the economy. So I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you. I think you should hold your head up high. This is, you are the hero of this rescue mission, and I appreciate it very much.
I wish the lifeboat were bigger. I said that on the House floor. A bigger lifeboat, more people in it. I sent out emails yesterday to folks who I just had to say, you aren't in this bill. And their stories are real.
Other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent does Oregon's lack of fiscal stability have a role in this problem that we had created and now are solving?
You and I agree, Senator, that a lot of our problems are based on our inability to manage the roller coaster that is our particular tax system. And in this case, one of the things that we have done over time, and we are, I mean, it's a fair criticism, when things get bad, we have borrowed from this program. We did it in 01. We've done it over time. And so when people say, well, if the legislature kept their hands off this, we wouldn't have been in this crisis. Well, that may or may not, I mean, I can't answer for past legislatures, but I can tell you that the instability of our system has led to us borrowing or actually taking from this program over time, or putting programs like OPI on it, which we did very recently because, again, we're on the bottom side of the roller coaster, and we're just scrambling around looking for change in our fiscal couch, if you will. And if we can find some in a program like this, we pull it out and we put it over here, and that destabilizes a program that had a stable funding. And so it's fair when folks say, well, if you kept your hands off it, meaning the legislature, we wouldn't be here. That is a fair criticism. It's gone on over time as things have, as the roller coaster has moved. But I am dealing with the crisis before me and crisis managing the crisis before me. And hope that as we move forward, we no longer have, look at this as sort of a pocket funding source, in a pinch. We've got to stop doing that.
Thank you. And thank you for your work on your side of the assembly on this bill. It's been very, very good. But I continue to be amazed, Madam Chair, colleagues, that our total lack of prioritization to solve these kinds of problems persists, and there seems to be no will to solve it. I don't understand it.
Thank you.
Other questions? Again, I want to express all of our appreciation. You have just injected the right balance of analysis, compassion, and commitment to save this program. This is not as big a lifeboat as any of us would want, and that's a very good analogy. But you did what other states have not been able to do, and that is save the core of the program for the very neediest people. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have two people signed up here, John Mullen and Rick Bennett.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen, I'm here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. In the 2011 session, we really recognized the need for this body to work on the solvency of the program. We also then quickly discovered, as did we all, that there were unknown and unintended consequences, and a number of people were caught up in a change that they hadn't anticipated. And Madam Chair, I know you were at the Hollywood Senior Center when there was quite a big discussion about it. And at the time, we all weren't sure where this was going to head. And I have to say that in working with the House Committee, Human Services Coalition testified, and we also asked for a bigger lifeboat, but understood that there were concerns about the ongoing solvency of the program. So I just really want to commend the work that was done on the House side for including as many people as they felt were possible. We also know that this is probably not the end of the discussion about the property tax deferral program, and so the Human Services Coalition stands ready to work with this body in the interim and then coming back to the 2013 session to take a look at some additional changes that will hopefully make sure that the program is solvent and targeted most effectively in the future. Thank you.
We appreciate that, and we take you up on your offer. Are there questions from the committee? Rick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. with John and others. This is a concern that I've been involved with since the fall of 2010. And I think Representative Berger and John as well have kind of provided the background and where we were at and what needed to be done. I would also say that, I think the reasons for the depleted reserves of this program certainly were related to the housing market, but also, as Representative Berger brought out, related to actions by previous legislatures. And in fact, certainly Advocates for Seniors wanted to see the Oregon Project Independence continued. And legislation a few sessions ago had been passed to allow the use of some of the reserves. But I think it was always the intent of the advocates that those dollars be used to supplement general fund. And instead, the reserves were used to totally fund OPI. And clearly were a major factor in the reserves of the program being depleted and presenting the problem that we were facing and so forth. The other piece of this related to our state revenues and so forth is in trying to provide some fund, near-term funding for cash flow purposes and so forth, revenue shortfalls and so forth didn't allow us to go to the general fund and just transfer some monies in. That, in fact, we had to be able to show that the program would be financially viable and be able to repay a loan if it was provided and then sustain itself over a longer period of time. And so there were certainly some changes that needed to be made. I don't think there were any easy options for us to consider. And I think everybody knew going in that there would be a certain number of people who were currently participating in the program who would be not able to continue. The other thing I would mention is the fact that in making those decisions, we were doing so with very limited data because, in fact, the eligibility before was simply related to age and income. And we really didn't know a lot about the participants. And certainly I don't think anybody realized just how many people who were in the program, the deferral program, had reverse mortgages. And I think that came to something of a surprise for many of us who were looking at the numbers and different options and so forth. So I would just say that, you know, this is not perfect. It would have been wonderful if we could have grandfathered in everybody who was in the program at the time we made these changes. Clearly that was not possible. And now, in trying to at least provide some assistance to those who have been impacted by the changes that were made, I think this is about the best we can do. It certainly provides some, at least temporary help to those with reverse mortgages. And I would hope, one of the other things in the bill, of course, is a survey related to program participants. And I hope with more information about those individuals that perhaps we can continue to work on this and fine-tune some of the requirements of the program as well. I would just also, as John has, thank Representative Berger and the members of the House Revenue Committee, and I thank you for your good intentions and your hard work as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? And thank you for your ongoing participation, both of you, in this. Okay, we have somebody from Bend who wants to testify, Mrs. Hornbeck. Do you know Mrs. Hornbeck's name?
Oh, yes.
What is her first name?
Joan.
Joan Hornbeck. So Christine will get her on the phone. Is this Mrs. Hornbeck?
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Senator Jenny Burdick, the chair of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and I'm sitting here with your Senator Chris Telfer and the rest of our committee to take your testimony on House Bill 4039.
Okay, thank you. I have notes, just so I don't forget something. I have already sent you a written testimony, but I just want to go over the highlights. My name is Joan Hornbeck. I live in Redmond, Oregon. And my husband, who will be 86 in April, is a World War II and Korean War veteran on disability. I'm also disabled and over 70. We were able to purchase a home in Redmond 3 years ago with our USDA Rural Home Loan for low-income seniors. It's a subsidized direct government loan with a 1% interest rate for 30 years. We moved in at the end of March 2009. And the big point is once we qualify, I contacted the Oregon State Tax Department by phone to see if we were eligible for a tax deferral. We knew we couldn't afford a payment, which included taxes. And the USDA doesn't allow us to choose a payment option on the taxes. And I was assured by the person I was speaking to that if our income didn't exceed the limit, that we would never lose the deferral and didn't have to requalify every year. And on that verbal assurance, we went ahead with the purchase. We would never have purchased a home otherwise. And we were only removed because of the 5-year stipulation. We still meet all of the other requirements. We paid our tax bill in November because we had to with our savings, leaving us under $1,000 for all future emergencies. And our home payment was immediately raised from $610 a month to $782 a month, so that now they're collecting the taxes in advance. And we have struggled the last few months to meet our obligations. We're only leaving us about $400 a month for living. And we're just asking that you can reconsider removing us and giving us the same reprieve as you're giving the reverse mortgages. When my husband passes away, I'll lose my home. I have only 80% of his Social Security and no living family to help. And also, finally, under the USDA guidelines, when title to our home changes, all taxes will be paid. The USDA does not allow liens against the property. So that's really all I have to ask for, and I appreciate anything that you can do for us.
Okay, thank you very much. So you don't have a reverse mortgage then?
And no, I don't.
And you're not eligible for one?
No, not under this government loan. Mm-hmm. We can't get anything changed on this loan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it is a direct loan from the government.
I see.
There's no third-party lender.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, only, you know, if we, because we're starting year four next month, if we were given this deferral like you're doing for the reverse mortgage, by the time that was up, we would be eligible again for the deferral on a permanent basis. And that's all we're asking for, so we don't get caught in the middle, because if my husband dies, I'll lose my home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions from the committee?
Just Joan, this is Senator Telfer. I appreciate you taking the time to call in. I know it's a snowy pass and not able to make that trip. We've talked, and I appreciate you taking the time to testify. Your situation is not unlike a few others that unfortunately are not in this new bill. So. We've talked about finding other ways, and I hope that you will just kind of hang in there and feel free to contact me, and we'll find a way to get you staying in that house for 2 years.
Well, I appreciate it, and whatever you can do will be really appreciated.
And thank you for calling in. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, since we went through our list, we have a new witness to sign up, Jody Weiser.
Welcome. For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So, we spent a lot of hours looking at this program, and our version of the history is a little different than some other versions we've heard. We started the property tax deferral program in 1964-5. I didn't bring my notes, so I may not be totally accurate, but it was in the mid-60s. And the state put in $190 million in the first decades of the program. That's how it handled the first, you know, paying taxes for several, well, a lot of biennium, actually. And then the programs, people started moving out of their houses or refinancing their houses, and so they were the loans were being repaid. And as I recall, it's about 12 years we actually had excess funds. So essentially what the original program's goals were, and it was stated in the legislation, that eventually that those funds would start repaying the general fund. And so it was repayment that was going on, not grabbing in some ways. But as Senator Morris pointed out, this was a program that was started years ago out of concern for low-income seniors, and general fund money was spent that way, and it could be spent that way now. And we're making decisions to do Connect Oregon and, you know, all sorts of other kinds of ideas where we're spending money that has less impact on individuals' lives than this does. Some research that Christine did shows that the average income of this of the applicants to the program is what I think was $17,500, in that range. So these are not people with lots of income. And most of them, if I recall right, had a net worth of $33,000, not including their home. There's no record of how much equity they have in their homes that DOR has. Also, Jones Hornbeck's issue that she brought up of thinking that she was going to be able to have this forever when she bought her house. In October of this year, I Googled Oregon Property Tax Deferral Program, and I got an application that said very clearly, big bold letters, application for 2011. And in the information about the application, it said very clearly that you could have a reverse mortgage and be in the property tax deferral program, because those were the rules when people were applying through last April. And the form was still online in October. So people were still being misled long after we knew there was a problem. There was a report in May of 2009 from the Department of Revenue showing that we were heading towards trouble. You know, we could have addressed this a long time ago. And so I think those people who bought their homes believing they would be able to be in this program, many of them were as serious at figuring out their financial situation as the testifier you just heard. You know, they counted every penny to figure out whether they should do what they should do. And that is a population that probably, if you're going to be good to the reverse mortgage people, you should be good to them, because they got the same information. They could be in the program. It didn't matter that they just bought their home. It's a much smaller number of individuals. The other thing that isn't in this bill and probably can't be this year but should be in the future is, this is probably the cheapest way we can house seniors, would be for us to have a social service program use the rules of, say, Section 8 housing and have a program where we do fund to, if the people meet all the qualifications for Section 8 housing, we would be able to either us or the counties or the cities or any of the jurisdictional levels would be able to fund people's property taxes. Because I don't think for an average of $2,500 we can house seniors anyplace else. It's not going to be as cheap anyplace else we would put them as it would to keep them in their homes, where they feel independent and where they were, until we blasted them out of the water, were feeling pretty emotionally secure as well as financially, like they had their ducks in line. I think also the study, that words in the and the bills makes it sound like the study that's being directed to be done is for people who are currently participating in the program. And the DOR has the contact information for the people who we just disqualified. It would probably make sense to include them in the study, too. The letter that you received today from Jerry Harden of Eugene, I don't know this person, but the recommendations he makes on page 2 are quite similar to the recommendations we made to the House Revenue Committee about things that we could do to change the bill. You're probably not going to do any of these kind of changes at this point in this session, but they should be considered in the interim and with plans for the next session.
But these are really, most of them, very vulnerable people. And we need to care about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. And this will be an ongoing discussion. In your analysis, did you, you talked about the money that was put into the program in its early years.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do any kind of an analysis of how much was paid back over the years through the legislature taking money out of the program?
You know, the program was first managed in one agency and then it moved to revenue. And I had on my list of things to do many times, but I never did it. But it was clear that we did not get to the $190 million. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's the time value of money. I mean, money that we, that the general fund put in 1968 would be worth way more now, and we didn't begin to meet that. But what was clear is that the early legislatures, and mind you, in 1965, we didn't have Medicare. We didn't have Social Security the way we have it now. So far more seniors lived in poverty. About 30% of seniors were living in poverty. Now less than 10% are living in poverty. But this program is mostly addressing that. I mean, we didn't really know. We knew we had some million-dollar properties, but we didn't know what kind of income people had. And we still don't know how much net worth they have in their homes, which I'm sure is one of the things you'll want to find out when you do the study.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this before we close the hearing? Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 4039. And in recognition that this is a project that will be ongoing for some time, but this is a short session, I will now open a work session on House Bill 4039. Senator Morris.
Do we have an amendment, -4, so that I believe have been...
Correct.
Vetted.
This is a technical amendment. Christine, do you have anything more to say about the amendment?
The A4 amendment is relatively minor. One thing it does is it requires the response within 65 days after the department sending the notification rather than 60 days after the receipt of the notification. And the thought about that is that you can't prove that there's a receipt of a notification, but you can prove that you've sent it. So it's just a known. There's just some language changes on page 3 in line 31 that a person would not be disqualified but be rendered ineligible. And the difference there would be that they would not have their repayment of their balance triggered until the usual events like moving out of the home or passing on. And rather than saying disqualified, it was renders ineligible, and that cleared up the language issue.
So they won't have to repay until the usual time.
Correct.
Okay. Questions? Christine? Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 4039.
Senator Morris has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 4039. Is there any discussion? Any objection to order? Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4039A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 4039 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Telfer.
I just want to say that, you know, it's disappointing that we could not include everybody. We could not maybe just have postponed the implementation of the bill from last session. You know, I know these people that, like Joan Hornbeck, are caught in this. They've lived in the house 3 years, but not five. What I will say, and I hope all the legislators, and I think we'll notify them all, that we're talking about 2 years that somebody has to now wait to reapply to get into the program. And in those 2 years, they're going to need to come up with about $2,200 a month. And what we've done in my district is contacted some of the other social service organizations to find if there's a way they can assist these people with those dollars, whether they pick up another utility bill, so that frees up the $200. So I would hope that the legislators would, you know, work with their communities and their social services to find ways that we can assist these people for the next 2 years so that they then qualify, having been in the house for 5 years, and can reapply into the program. So, you know, while this bill isn't everything I would like it to be, it is a vast improvement over the bill that we passed last session with unintended consequences. So I'll be a disappointed yes on the bill.
Okay. Other discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1558. Welcome, Mazin.
Morning, Chair Rudick, members of the committee. It's 15 to 12.
Is it lunchtime already?
It's 15 to 12. The day is 15, the month is 2, and it's 12.
Oh, okay.
All
right.
Sorry. Said it quick.
It's the European way of
doing
things.
It's a little early for that kind of stuff.
Having said that,
who's winning? The 15 to 12.
That's what I picked up too.
The Senate Bill 1558 is the bill that we've talked about a couple of days ago, and this is about the conduit revenue bonds through Business Oregon Economic Development, and we had the discussions about the. Way this bill is being proposed to be amended with a dash one, and the dash one amendment is one that puts more sideboards and allows the Business Oregon or the Oregon Economic Development to be looking at ways on how to make this program more within the confines of a bond rather than a venture capital. And I guess that at that time we did not have an impact statement from the fiscal, and today we do, Chair.
And, you know, I opened this as a public hearing, which I should have opened a work session, but since I did open it as a public hearing, is there anyone who'd like to testify? Okay,
Madam Chair, if I might, I maybe have Paul come up. I continue to be in question about the using this kind of a financing vehicle for research and development and working capital. And I would be curious to know, in the use of revenue bonds, in the history the history in the state and maybe even other states, have those provisions been included for the use of the bonds, working capital and research and development?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senator Morse, to your question, and I'm going to defer to John Saris, who administers the Industrial Development Bond Program, and he can answer the particulars to your question specific to Oregon and those other states as well. So with that, I'll leave it to John.
Nice introduction.
Chair Burdick,
members of the committee.
Madam Chair, I know we had this discussion before, but I'd like to explore
just a
little
bit
further.
I would like to, too. So go ahead.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senator Morris, to answer your question,
give your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
He threw you off the rails here.
My name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. There are There was some recent history of research and development being allowed as an eligible use within private activity or conduit bonds. Most specifically, as part of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, there were some provisions that allowed research and development to be included in what were called recovery zone facility bonds. So that's the most recent. Those provisions were as of 2009. They were a limited duration that did sunset at the end of 2010 with the recovery zone facility bond project. There historically has been some provisions for the allowance of soft costs through the financing of tax-exempt private activity bonds at the federal level. And there are some instances of other states and jurisdictions allowing working capital as a component of a private activity bond. It may not be tax exempt under the federal statutes and regulations, but it would be an allowable use at the local level. The localities that have used this in the past, it has had some limited use. It is not by any means a major or significant portion of the financing that is typically associated with a project, but it has been done in the past.
How will we know if there gets to be a problem with this? I mean, who's watching it, and how will we know if we made a mistake or needed more sideboards on this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that we're going to need to continue to monitor these projects that have components of working capital and R&D, and we would continue to do so. We would be notified of any events of the bonds basically defaulting, and basically the state does have a process in which we basically convert these from bonds to a form of debt that can be liquidated. And so we would be able to see what is occurring within the portfolio. The one thing that I did mention when we testified last time around, this is going to be probably a limited use within the program, and this is not a high volume type of program either. We're talking, you know, once again about maybe 2 to 5 projects a year, and the percentage of projects that may have this allowable use as a portion of the project may be somewhat limited. We've yet to see, you know, how it may be used in the future.
Okay. Senator Telfer.
John, thank you, Madam Chair. John, the process of Business Oregon, though, in looking at the feasibility of a project and the overall company, you look at other assets. I mean, you look at the stability of the company on a whole, the entire balance sheet. So it isn't just this one narrow look at the use of these funds and that project, but you do look at the entire stability of the company in general.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, you're correct. We do look at, as you mentioned, the merits of the total project and the uses of funds that are used within each eligible project, whether it's for equipment or a facility expansion or potentially some component of working capital. We also look at the quality of the guarantors, not just the corporations or the entities that are guaranteeing the loans, but also of the individuals that may be providing personal guarantees as well as part of the project. Additionally, there are some safeguards that can be put into place through administrative rules as it relates to the remarketing of bonds, once again protecting the name and reputation of the state and the integrity of the program itself. As bonds like this are sold, and we do have a history of working on projects that are earlier stage, and these bonds are sold to qualified investors, they sign what are called big boy letter of credits, basically saying that they understand the risk that they're getting into as they're purchasing these bonds. You can take that same requirement and make those requirements associated with the remarketing of the bonds as well, so that the buyers of those bonds, when they're remarketed, understand the risks associated with the bonds that they're buying.
Oh, and just a follow up on Senator Burdick's question on how we would hear. So when we hit a home run with one of these things, we'll certainly hear too, won't we?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, of course.
Senator Telfer, I think that is your job.
You'll hear.
Senator Burdick.
Yes.
Since this is a new law introduced into the statute, I think that the tradition or the way this would be done is that the department would set rules in how to implement the new law. And those rules would, I believe, come back to Legislative Council to be approved before you. Is that how you anticipate?
Madam Chair, members, yes, the rules would be reviewed by Department of Justice and Ledge Council as part of the process for approving the final rules.
No, that's useful information. Senator Morris, did you get your questions
answered? Yeah, and I very much appreciate this discussion, but I'm getting more comfortable, and I hope Senator Telfer's district lands a whopper.
Well, I do too, and most of them are here. They just walked in, so it appears that most of Central Oregon is here.
Well, and it's very good news that Senator Morris is comfortable because I rely on him to make the motions. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1558 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1558. Senator Morris. We have a dash one amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1558 dated 2/2/12.
Senator Morris has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1558. Is there any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1558 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 1558 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Telfer, how about you carry this?
I would love it.
All right. That concludes our business today, so we are adjourned. Adjourned.